This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Until very recently, Dmitry Bykov was a big presence on the Russian literary scene. He's a novelist, a poet, a biographer, and a critic. He's also one of the most outspoken and brilliant critics of Russian life and politics. He was a frequent presence on Echo of Moscow, the liberal radio station that was finally shut down after the invasion of Ukraine. And as a commentator, he pronounced scathing judgments, truly scathing, on the nature and character of Vladimir Putin and the increasingly authoritarian regime he was building. And that never endeared him to those in power. In recent years, Bykov has been teaching on and off in the United States at Cornell University, but because of his forthright opposition to the war in Ukraine, it's not at all clear that he'll ever return home. You were just in Ukraine. Tell me about the circumstances of the trip and what you saw.
You can only feel it. You know, that's really a strange feeling of people who live after death. They have decided for them on the 23rd of February that they are dead, that everything is lost. And now they are quite free. You know, that's like Japanese school of samurai. Imagine that you are dead and then act. You are living after death. Everything is finished. So feel yourself free and decisive. They are free and decisive. It's a kind of carnival after death. It's very merry and very horrifying. The people who really decided to die for their country because they have no exit, they really feel the firm wall behind them.
There's no exit.
Yeah, no exit and no place to run. Most of men before 60 just are forbidden to leave the country. And by the way, there were so long lines to get arms to join the so-called territorial defense. You never could imagine such an active population, especially to compare them with Russian population, which prefers to spend its time in restaurants as if nothing happened. So all Ukraine is mobilized, and all Ukraine is a kind of plasma which is ready for transformation in something unpredictable and maybe unimaginable.
Tell me how you received the news that Russia, under Putin, was invading Ukraine. Did it take you by surprise, or was this just an extension of what began in 2014?
Well, you know, there is a really complicated problem because I was waiting for the war for recent 20 years. I was predicting it in most of my books. And, for example, one of my books is just called The Chronicle of the Near East War. I was ready for it, but I was sure that war between Russia and Ukraine would be delayed somehow. And I was waiting for it maybe next year. And now I came to continue my work in America after the winter vacations in the middle of February, just after my visit to Kyiv. And then when I appeared here, a week later, the war began.
It's hard to explain to people who have never been there, but for the past decades, People who are in your milieu, writers, journalists, and then also business people and all kinds of people lived a kind of double life, to say the least, in Moscow, which is to say it was distinctly post-Soviet. Certain things existed that had never existed before. If I walked into a bookshop in Moscow or Petersburg or anywhere else, I could find books by Dmitry Bykov and many, many others that would never have been there in the certainly late Soviet period. There were restaurants and there was a social life and a commercial life that had exploded. But at the same time, Putinism existed. How, describe for us, for an American, what that deceptive kind of semi-authoritarian, semi-democratic culture was before the war in Ukraine?
Well, as for me, there was nothing, practically nothing new. You know, the dictatorship was not evident in Russia. You couldn't feel it, for example. My books were not forbidden till March, and you could buy them. But as for the opposition, they were always feeling the pressure. For example, I was banned as a teacher, as a lecturer. I couldn't, for example, teach in official university, only in private schools. I had right to, had a license to read lectures, for example, for adults, not for children, but only in my private lectorium, the straight speech. I wasn't allowed as an official teacher. Then most of Russian oppositioners were always checked for their financial documents and for their non-extremism. You know that extremism is a typical verdict for Russian oppositioners. The restaurants are open, so the life is normal. Mm-hmm. You see, one of my friends said they go to restaurants because they have no other business. Everything except restaurants is forbidden. So maybe the dictatorship wasn't evident for foreign guests and for Russian Philistines who waste their time in restaurants. There is no journalism. There is no normal business. Only business which is allowed by the state and so on. By the way, in one of Vasily Bykov's novels, The Sign of Drama or The Sign of Trauma, he wrote, "My only freedom is to smoke, because when I smoke, maybe that's the sign of free will." So for everybody who could see evident things, it was quite clear that dictatorship is not only near, dictatorship is here. And we understood it. You felt, being a poet, being a writer, being too sensitive maybe to be happy, you were feeling the horrifying pressure which was strengthening all the time. Sometimes you could feel, exceptionally being drunk, you could feel that this is your motherland, you're at home. But most of the time, I felt myself being at home in an American bookstore.
You felt most at home being in an American bookstore. Did you feel that way in the early 90s, in the first flush of the post-Soviet period? How long did it take before it became evident that any glimmer of a democratic possibility in Russia was over?
Well, you see, only Americans, only naive Americans could believe in democratic possibilities in the 90s. I lived there and I could see it. There were no democracy. There was a kind of new dictatorship, and so Yeltsin wasn't a democrat at all. He tried to be democrat, but he was a typical party leader who always creates extremal situations because he can act only in such situations, not in a peaceful world. As for me, I was quite sure even in the end of '80s, and I was writing about it in my young and non-experienced journalism. In the end of '80s, I was writing much that the destroying of the Soviet Union was an attempt to destroy a complicated system. You know, maybe the complication of system is the only measure of freedom. The Soviet Union was not as simple and straight as it is described, for example, abroad or in the novels of Russian dissidents. there were many types of people and many types of communities in Soviet Russia. So 90s were the decade of degradation, of the decay in all spheres of life, in culture, in science, in social sciences, and so on. There were some perspectives for the Soviet Union, like, for example, in a complicated chess party and chess game, but all the figures were thrown away from the board. And that's the reason.
All the pieces were swept off
the
board.
Yes, yes. And that's the reason that the Soviet Union was not transformed. It was not transformed. It could be transformed, sure, but it wasn't.
What meaning does Putin therefore have? Was Putin a logical continuation of the Yeltsin you described from the 90s?
I must say that indeed Putin seems to be a real follower of Yeltsin, because Yeltsin's way of decision of solution of all problems was to shoot, like in Chechnya, for example, and in 1993. You know, Soviet Minister of Defense Paul Grachev said that we can take Grozny for 3 hours, and Russia was was killing its soldiers there for 10 years. They were sure that they'll take Kiev for 3 days. And now we understand that Ukraine appeared the giant swamp for Russian, militaries, and maybe this war is for years. They can't take even Lysychansk. I think that Putin is just the final stage of Russian decline, because, you know, he's maybe the simplest, the most primitive figure in Russian power. He's so much smaller than the country, not only because he is small in general, but because his figure is comically and finally little.
Why do you say that? For years, much of the foreign press would talk about Putin as a master strategist, as far more experienced in the ways of power in the Machiavellian sense than anyone else on the world stage. You're describing him as a pipsqueak.
Well, not pipsqueak, but really primitive figure. Yeah, you see.
How do you mean?
It's very simple to be a strategist in Russia. You know, when the patience of people is endless, and when you can do practically everything with them, including, for example, public executions. Maybe that's the limit of their power, yeah? You can do everything. And maybe this strategy is right. This strategy is not wrong because, you know, Vladimir Volodin, the speaker of Russian parliament, said there would be no Russia without Putin. Maybe he's right, because in Russia, Putin is the only and the last version of Russian Tsar. After him, there would be no legal governor of Russia. He is the last person who can unite the country somehow. You know, in Russia, they have just very clear choice to change the country, to change themselves, or to keep Putin. They prefer to keep Putin. So they're really ready to die, but not to change their mind.
I'm talking with the Russian writer Dmitry Bykov. More in a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
You seem to say it's impossible for anyone to imagine a Russia after Putin. Putin is a mortal figure. Can you imagine Russia politically after Putin?
Well, as for me, I can imagine, first of all, federal Russia, Russia with self-government, with regions which can govern themselves without directions of the center. But, you know, in Russia, most of people will oppose you. They will say, you call to the destroy of the system. You want to destroy the system. Most of them will run away from the center. I am sure that the only way to keep Russia as the whole, Russian as in Russia, as integrity, is to give all the rights to the government in places, for example, in cities, in republics, and so on, to make something like the United States of Russia. But in Russia, this idea is not popular because everybody believes only in centralization, only in central power and pyramid of power, in the so-called vertical. I'm sure that after Putin, we wouldn't keep the vertical system of power. But most of people are sure that in paternalist or maternalist state like Russia, nobody can be free. Because when you take decisions, like voting, for example, you are responsible for it. Most of Russian population wants to make Putin responsible for everything, to say after him, we didn't know, we couldn't prevent him. So this runaway from responsibility is very comfortable for life.
Dmitry, you seem to hold the view that Americans mainly never permit themselves, which is to think of something as fixed and unchangeable. You seem to have the view that Russia is eternally doomed to some form of totalitarianism or authoritarianism, and to have a fate that will never see it free.
By the way, you know, it's not maybe a totalitarian power. It's some strange type of freedom. I'll explain. One of my students gave me the universal answer. I asked them in one of the groups teaching post-Soviet Russia. How can you describe the system where nobody believes in totalitarian ideas, where everybody are joking about it and laughing at it, but nevertheless they're obedient? Is it the country of slaves or the country of free people who are really free deep in their hearts? And one of my students said, in Russia, slavery and freedom are not mutually exclusive. That's quite right. Maybe we're the country of most free slaves, most obedient, and maybe sometimes most quiet, but deep in their heart, they never believe to the words they say. So it means that real, true fascism in Russia is not possible, because fascism is a type of intellectual discipline. But there is an imitative fascism. And most of the country is really serving Putin without any deep belief in his abilities or ideas. I'm quite sure that in Russia there are maybe 5% who really hate Ukrainians for their idea of freedom. And maybe 5% are liberals. And 90% are just waiting for any unseen future, any unpredictable future.
Dmitry, do you have family and friends in Ukraine?
Well, I have family only in the USA, and my ex-family, for example, my oldest son lives in Russia. That's a strange thing, really. But, for example, if during the night I'll come as a guest to most of my Ukraine friends, they'll be happy to see me. I can't see it about my Russian friends. They wouldn't be happy. Not only because maybe they're Putinists. No, maybe sometimes they are my followers still. But, you know, in Russia, people are not happy when they see a night guest. They're afraid of him. Generally, maybe I have in Ukraine about 100 or 200 close friends, real intimate friends. And in Russia, maybe 10 people.
Really? Only 10 friends in Russia?
Only 10, yeah. You know, sometimes I feel a kind of nostalgia and I want to call something, just to call and to talk. But most of those people are dead. You know, I'm old enough. And some of them changed radically and I can't recognize them. And only 10 of them would be glad to hear me.
You know, you and I were emailing and I asked you, do you think that you have seen Russia for the last time?
Well, you know, it's a national sport in Russia to imagine that you see everything for the last time. When I left Russia half a year ago, I was quite sure that I'll be back. And even now, I'm quite sure that I'll be back very soon. I'm sure that we'll meet the new year, as usual, at Echo of Moscow, which is banned now. At the same building at Novy Arbat, we'll celebrate the new year.
Whoa, 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 wait. What you're saying is by the end of the year, not only will you be back in Moscow.
By the end of the year, because we'll have the radical change in August and the disappearance of Putin's regime in October. That's not only my prediction. I have a very professional predictor in Russia who agrees with me.
Who is that?
Just a girl from my class. And I have talks with my friends. Most of sensitive friends feel the nearing of catastrophe.
And the catastrophe would be what?
I can't say. Maybe it would be a typical Russian revolution, senseless, as Pushkin said, and cruel. Putin's ideas are not very popular among his surroundings. I can't imagine how it happens. I only see the direction. Maybe I give 10 or 15% for peaceful development of this situation. But, you know, every his step is worse, for example, than yesterday.
Dmitry Bykov, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Bye.
Dmitry Bykov, novelist, poet, biographer, journalist, and broadcaster, and now a man without a country. He's currently teaching in the U.S. at the Institute for European Studies, based at Cornell University. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and this week we're saying our goodbyes to producer Alex Barron. In his years on the program, Alex worked on stories about the treatment of terrorist suspects, a Confederate monument in Maryland, quite a few humor pieces, and he has a particular interest in the culture of the internet, like the time he reported on the GameStop craze.
I am not an investment guy. I've never bought an individual share of stock in my life, but I found all of this really exciting, and so I spent $400 to buy a share of GameStop. Actually, 1.090222 shares.
Needless to say, he sold at a loss. Alex, keep making great stuff and stay away from the day trading. Best of luck to you always. That's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Brita Green, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Louis Mitchell, and Ngofen Mputubwele, with help from David Gable, Harrison Keithline, Alex Barish, Victor Guan, and Mengfei Chen. And we had original music this week by Alex Barron.
We had additional help this week from Michael May and James Napoli.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
WNYC Studios is supported by W.W. Norton & Company, publishers of The Road to Freedom, Economics and the Good Society, by Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph E. Stiglitz. The Road to Freedom, essential reading for those committed to the American ideal of an economic and political system that delivers well-being, opportunity, and meaningful freedoms for all. The Road to Freedom, available now wherever books are sold.